It's a blessing for me to be here. I have heard of the Schertz Lectureship many times. I don't think I've ever been able to be here because of my school requirements. But BJ has been here many times, and you all have treated him wonderfully. And he speaks often and highly of the people at Schertz. Ladies of Schertz, I know you're exhausted. I know what the lectureship does to you and how hard it is and how much you prepare for it and the week of it. And I tell the student wives that I tell their husbands after the lectureship in Memphis, they are required to go home and rub their wives' feet. So you just tell them that I said, as the final speaker for the ladies, that your husbands had to rub your feet at home. I want you to think about Job's wife. We don't often focus on her that much, really. The book is about Job and mainly more about God than her. But in one single, solitary moment in time, heartbreaking tragedy beheld Job and his wife. And isn't that how it happens? From one heartbeat to the next, I can remember to this day when I got the phone call that my grandmother had died. And it was the second time in my life that I literally fell to my knees. It's just something, I mean, when tragedy strikes, it does strike that way. There's usually no warning. So the tragedy that befell, that happened to Job and his wife, though, is something that most of us would say we've never experienced, the type of tragedy that they had. You know, three times a servant came to Job and told him devastating news, financial news, that he lost everything financially. But it was that fourth student that brought the worst news, the tragedy that none of us want to have experiencing, the announcement of a death of a child, and not only one in their case, but all 10. And I cannot fathom that. I cannot fathom that. Job's response to tear his mantle, shave his head, and fall on his knees in worship to God was a true indication of who ruled in his heart. And I think it's an indication strongly of his faith. Because often, you know, when I fell to my knees, it was an extreme heartache. It wasn't with an automatic reaction to turn to God. So the righteousness that Job exhibited is so higher than so many times we do in our own tragedies. Job turned to God in his deepest anguish. However, we know that Satan wasn't through with him, was he? While he was still reeling with an anguished heart, you know, he smote Job with sore boils from the sole of his foot unto his crown. And, you know, physically, to have that tremendous emotional anguish that he's feeling in his heart, and then to be hit physically like this, you know, he took him from the inside out and tried to destroy him. It was clear from Job 1 and 2 that he was a broken man at this point. And he was in desperate need of his helpmeet. Isn't that why God created woman? To be the helpmeet for man? And she does enter the scene. But she doesn't enter the scene as the crown of creation like Eve did. No, she enters the scene much more like the Eve that fell to the garden to Satan. When she said, "Dost thou still retain thine integrity, curse God, and die," in Job 2:9? These are incredibly hate-filled words. I cannot imagine saying that to my husband, especially when he is like beaten and bruised and down. She's supposed to be speaking to the one that she cherishes, the one that she should love with her whole heart, right? God in his wisdom didn't include any other information about Job's wife to us, but this one statement that she had. So we really have to be careful what we surmise about her, what we conclude, and what we can infer. We have to be very careful about that. And I looked at many different translations of that one verse in 2 verse 9, and they're all over the map about what it truly means with that. I'm going to take it just as it was stated. And we're going to think and understand that she obviously was suffering greatly as Job. She lost the same children that he did. She lost the same financial success that he had. She saw her husband suffering from tremendous physical agony. And she let her pain at what had happened supersede her faith in God. So unless we wholeheartedly condemn her rash statement, we need to understand, we don't know how we would respond necessarily in that tremendous emotional and physical pain. And we need to be very careful. We need to maybe acquit ourselves like Job did, because his wife obviously hadn't done that. She did fall at that moment and say that. Have we not also, though, uttered foolish words that we wish we could take back? So I don't want to condemn her wholeheartedly. You know, she was in tremendous pain. But she can't be excused just because it was a simple human reaction. We are called to a higher standard, aren't we? We are called to imitate our God, to walk in love as He has shown us in Ephesians 5, 1 through 2. And she did not walk in love the way she spoke to her husband. Her reaction, viewed with this perspective, that she was suffering as greatly as Job, helps us view her maybe with a little more compassionate eyes. They both lost their financial possessions. They both lost their children. And that's a grief beyond compare. When I did a research years ago on things that break up a marriage, that's the number one thing that breaks up a marriage is the loss of a child. So can you imagine losing all of them at one time? For her to witness her husband's tremendous physical pain, though, and not be able to help him appeared to be her breaking point. When she saw him sitting in the ashes, scraping his boils with that potsherd, either it was because her love for him could not bear to see him in pain, or because she lacked the empathy to care for him in his pain. If this was the case, then she appears to be so bitter and angry at this that she's witnessing that she can't see through her own pain to see her husband's. She was blinded to his physical suffering and totally absconded her caregiver role, the God-given helpmeet role. The Bible contains no more information about her. So we're not going to speculate. Either each of us has a breaking point. We all know that, right? So we need to look to God for our strength. That's the first lesson we need to learn about Job's wife. She did not turn to God. And whenever we face that breaking point, we need to look up to God. We don't need to look down. What is the godly response to loss, to marital struggles, to health issues? Because we're all going to face it at some point. How do we find the strength to still encourage our spouse when we're as devastated as well? So how do we go on? So what do we do in this case? Well, in the very beginning, God knew man's greatest need would be for companionship. We talked about the fact that He created Eve as a helpmeet for him. In Genesis 2:18, it's not good that man should be alone. I will make him an helpmeet for him. In the first couple, you know, Eve was necessary for procreation, right? But she was vital in Adam's life as well. Now think about all of this. They tended the garden together, right? They were cast out together, built a new life together, and struggled through childbirth together. Who else did Eve have to turn to? She didn't go to the hospital. She didn't have a nurse. She didn't even have a trusted sister or mother, right? They had to do all of this together. And then again, together, they bore the tremendous grief when Cain killed Abel. Now think about that loss. There's a wealth of love and healing in the simple statement that we often pass over in Genesis 4:25. And Adam knew his wife again, and she bare a son, and called his name Seth. For God said, she hath appointed me another steed instead of Abel, whom Cain slew. Together they navigated the point of grief, together. And that's a key thing. When we do things together, it's very, very important. One husband who experienced the painful loss of a child offered his insight. You know, we don't anticipate that. We don't plan to lose a child, do we? He said, a dozen years of marriage had created thick layers of trust, love, selflessness, and respect. That's what they had. These layers were peeled away and now revealed nerves that were there, raw and unprotected. So you can imagine what she's feeling with the loss of all of them. Even the most solid marriages have their foundations rocked with the death of a child. And I can remember at my mother's funeral, my grandmother falling in my arms and crying out, I don't know how to bury my child. How do you bury all 10 in one day? How do you do that? It was uncharted territory. It was an event my grandmother was not prepared for. I'm sure Job's wife wasn't prepared for it. You know, we dream of the joys in life. We dream of marriage with our children. We dream of their children's births, the milestones that they will make. We don't plan for the heartaches because we foolishly think it won't happen to us. We plan for all of the joys. They're going to go to college. He's going to grow up and be a preacher. He's already a dinosaur expert. You know, we plan all this stuff. We don't plan for the heartaches because we believe life is a fairy tale until the day that it isn't. And we're not prepared for the beyond the fairy tale. But those of us that have been married a long time, young girls, you got to prepare because it isn't going to be a bed of roses all your life. Heartache is going to come. Heartache that's going to take you to your knees is going to come. And we need to prepare for that. So what is a Christian wife's response to loss? It's important to understand that men and women tend to grieve differently. And while they don't always fit into this mold, one of the psychiatrists explains that males typically grieve by moving past the painful situation and getting involved in work or other activities. It's like they just put it out of their mind. Although women respond to loss with a deep need for connection and emotional support. So we respond completely different, right? We want that connection. We want to be held. We want to talk about it. We feel the need for that. She further explains that those inclined to the male model will keep grief to themselves, work hard to avoid losing control in front of others, and refrain from asking for help or assistance. In the female model, feeling related or connected is of paramount importance, while in the male model, feeling independent and autonomous is critical. It's almost as if they're saying, if I can put a barrier around me, it won't hurt so bad if I don't feel it. It's likely that one may want to attend a support group while the other one is adamantly opposed to it. And have you not had marriage counseling when you've tried to talk with a couple before and you're dragging one in to the room with his wife and the other one's willing, one's not? Many men do not know how to share or even desire to show their emotions, even to their own wife. It's just the way they're made. And we need to understand that. Marriage counselors refer it as the man cave. I just want a show of hands, wives. Do your men go in the man cave? Come on, mine can't be the only one that goes into the man cave. My husband will definitely go into the man cave. Okay? It's like he needs to recharge. He needs to think through some things. And he needs to deal with the problems. And he doesn't want to be really concerned with what you're thinking right now. He just has to go in and seclude himself and just almost be silent for a while. And it can last for days. However, we women, we're the emotional half, right? I don't know if I know how to be silent when I'm upset about something. I'm pretty vocal when I'm upset. I may not know how to express it well, but I'm either going to start crying or even laughing. It just depends on the nerves at the moment. But something's going to bubble out and come out. Both of these personalities, the man in the man cave and the woman who is emotional, can collide together, and it's almost like a war zone. Because if she desperately is needing to talk about it and needing to be held and he's not there yet, that's where the first rift comes about in a couple. So we need to consider the reality of how we're going to react, because we've never been faced with this kind of tragedy. So we need to try to prepare for something. It can be really hard to know how you're going to respond or even your spouse will respond in something like this. Most would agree that men tend to be the strong, silent type and hold it all in, and we're the emotional ones that want to talk it all out. Well, is it possible to merge both of these personalities together and to find a solution? Because if this continues, this tailspin of tragedy, that's when the marriage could break up, if we can't pull it back together. So what is a Christian wife's response? Well, knowledge is important. We need to understand how God made our husbands. Knowing about our different natures, we need to understand that they need some time. They need time to think it through. They need time to consider what is happening. What do they need to do to fix the problem? Because men are fixers. Now, my husband can't take a screwdriver or a hammer literally to save his life. His parents gave me a toolkit when we first got married. And I didn't understand the symbolism of that, truly. But he really can't do that. He really doesn't understand. I mean, when he showed me the trailer that we're going to live in before we got married, and I'm walking down the hall, and I see my picture a foot from the floor, and I said, what's my picture doing down there? Well, that's where the nail was. I'm telling you, he doesn't know how to fix things that way, okay? But he knows how to call the man now. So we've got the phone numbers. He can do that. He's good, okay? But I need to understand that I can't bombard him with all this stuff, you know? He needs time to work it through. He needs time to himself, time to order his thoughts, time to deal with his raw emotions and his vulnerabilities. You know, he's supposed to be the strong one. And what he probably wants to do is fall apart crying on his knees too. But he doesn't feel like he can do that in front of you. So he needs time. And that is a vital thing for him, to recharge, gain the mental strength, to be the home's leader, to face those overwhelming difficulties. The man needs to realize, though, that his wife was built to nurture, right? So what do we want to do? I'll tell you what we want to do. When my husband hung his wedding ring on a basketball goal about 2 years after we got married and nearly tore his finger off, you could see the bone and the blood and all of that good gory stuff. This is what we want to do. While Van Van Sant, one of our preacher friends, was driving 80 miles an hour down two country roads to get to a hospital, his wife was in the back seat hyperventilating in a paper bag about to pass out, and I'm over the seat with my arms around my husband, holding his hand over the cup, like he can't do it by himself. And finally, he leaned out, he like turned his head into my ear. I mean, my head is right there next to his. I am practically on his lap in the seat. Honey, you are hurting me more. What we want to do is nurture and love, and we want to take care of him and fix him. He doesn't need that right that moment, okay? That's the way God made us, but sometimes we have to pull back a moment, okay? So he's got to understand that about us. We have to understand that they need a little bit of time. There's a beautiful biblical example of this. When we think of David and Bathsheba with the loss of their son, when faced with the consequences of his sin, David was told by Nathan that their child would die. Can you imagine that conversation and the heartache that David knows? His reaction was to withdraw as he besought God for the child, and David fasted and went in and lay all night upon the earth. And the elders of his house arose and went to him to raise him up from the earth, but he would not, neither did he eat bread with them. That's in 1 Samuel 12:16-17. And that time of fasting and prayer lasted for 7 days. And it wasn't until the death of the child that David arose and washed himself, came out of seclusion. Now, his grief was based on the consequences of his sin. That's not the same as Job, and that's not the same as some tragedies that befall a family through sickness or consequences of a car accident or whatever. So it's not exactly the same as parents today. But the man's reaction is often going to be the same, isn't it? It took David time to be able to go to Bathsheba and to comfort her. And often it's going to take our husband's time to be able to comfort us. From the wife's perspective, we may feel abandoned and alone in our grief. And I will say that he can't stay in his little cave a long time. He can't, because that means he's absconding in his role. He needs to understand our need for emotional support even while he's trying to regroup. So we must never forget that we are in this together, whatever the this is. So even if we're separate for a little while he's trying to deal with his emotions, we are in this together. And we cannot let the tragedy of whatever has befallen us pull us apart, right? After David's period of fasting, he arose, washed himself, he ate, and he comforted his wife. He didn't need to be coaxed out of his seclusion, although some husbands will need to be. If you're facing a similar experience with your husband, you may find it difficult to communicate with him about your grief, and he may find it difficult to communicate with you. You have to come together. Even if you just sit there and hold hands and cry, for a while because you don't have the words to say. You have to be together. He may not be willing to open up to you after a short period of time. So you may need to lovingly, and that's different than, you know, Job didn't lovingly confront her husband. We may need to lovingly confront him in order to help him be able to talk through his grief. Communication is the key, and you have to open up a channel of communication. David, a man after God's own heart, opened his heart to his wife and found the strength to comfort her in 2 Samuel 12:24. And it's important to note that she did not turn him away. So even if we're feeling abandoned for a time while he's working through his grief, we need to welcome him with open arms. The goal is you're a couple. You're united. You're focused to try to get through this together. Job's wife said hateful words to her husband, which was an indication of her heart. Eve was another wife whose words were an indication of her heart. You know, when she fell to the temptation in the garden, she's known for encouraging her husband to partake of the fruit. Well, that wasn't a wifely, godly example, was it? This action for her is parallel to something we might expect from Jezebel or Delilah or the immoral woman of Proverbs. And yet it was the crown of creation, right? At the end of the chapter in Genesis, we see a broken couple, don't we? We see a couple banished from the garden, the ultimate paradise on earth created by God. There they are. And you often see pictures of Eve in the garden and Adam, and they're with their heads down, slowly leaving the exile from the garden and the pain that they were feeling. The Bible makes it clear, we know that their life would be filled with sweat and toil, thistles and thorns in Genesis 3. And truly at this point, Eve is in a mental fork in the road, isn't she? She could continue to walk down the path that she had begun, the path of sin, persuading her husband to follow her, as she had in the garden, right? And fruitlessly search for happiness. Or she could set aside her shame, turn to her God, and walk in his path. Deuteronomy 8:6 and Micah 6:8 talks about that. And that would lead to her rest and peace, Psalm 23. While Eve's life would be much harder than the fall, we know what path she chose, don't we? She walked God's path, like Psalm 119:35 and 67, 71, and 105 of that same chapter, 119, talk about. And that path, to choose to walk in his path, is always the right path. Yes, their life was hard. Yes, it was a consequence of their sin. But she turned back to God. Eve's statement after having Seth revealed her relationship with God. She gave him the credit for the birth of Seth. And that's a beautiful testimony to Eve. We all sin. We all say foolish things. We all have consequences for the sin that we do. But when we stand up and we turn and repent and walk the path that we're supposed to, and the reaction that we have, that's the testimony of who we are. The psalmist's words years after this Bible event could apply to her. I thought on my ways and turned my feet unto thy testimonies. Psalm 119:59. In her grief, she turned to her husband and she turned back to her God. The consequences for their sin were not removed, but it's always the right choice to walk in his path. She was no longer in the same ranks as those wicked women of the Bible. Great joy and salvation came through the line of Seth, remember? Luke 3:38, his line led to Christ. So even after tremendous tragedy, the joy that came from that. Again, Adam and Eve continued together through the shattering loss of their two sons. Now imagine this, they didn't just die. One of them murdered the other one. So that's just a grief that is unimaginable. So one, you know, they lost Abel and they lost Cain. They lost him because he chose to continue to walk the wicked path. But they found joy again in one another, didn't they? Adam and Eve. Just like David and Bathsheba once again found joy. It's a God-given, life-affirming act for spouses to comfort each other in this way. But in order to be physically close, you have to open yourself up emotionally, right? You have to be together emotionally with this. And he does to you too. So you may have to have help getting through this. During a loss, we have to cling to one another. We can't build walls of grief. We can't lock the other one out. Both Eve and Bathsheba reciprocated their husband's affection, and we need to be there for one another. The Bible doesn't offer any words uttered by these two grief-stricken wives like the words that Job's wife gave to him. We don't see any of that from Eve or Bathsheba. God made men and women completely different. Man was created to lead and guide, right? He's the protector. He's the leader of the home. Woman was created to tenderly give of herself. And that's the role that we have. Put yourself in your husband's shoes when this happens to your family. He, the protector and the strength of the home, he's probably feeling guilt, whether it's even justified or not. He's feeling guilt that he wasn't able to stop the loss of the child or the loss of financial struggles in your home. So we, as the women with the innate need to nurture and to guide him, we're going to have to recognize this about him, and we're going to have to understand that right now he's feeling very vulnerable. He's feeling very weak and helpless. And we have to help him through this. We need to help him understand that he has tremendous strength. And you still view him as the protector and the leader of your home and the strength of your home. That you still view him that and understand and explain to him, life and death are not in his hands. He doesn't bear guilt for that. He may need you to help him understand if there's a big financial loss. Okay? If he did something that caused it, do you two still stand together? Because you know that's not a reason for divorce, right? Or what if he didn't, but you still lost everything? I tell my husband all the time, I could live in a tiny home with you anywhere. His father lives with us. He's 80, so we tease him that he has the loft. But do you tell your husband that, you know, all of this stuff that he wants to give you and the blessing, that none of that is what matters? What matters is him. In the life you have with him, he may need your tender guidance back to not blaming himself, or maybe if he needs to repent of some sin, back to God with this wonderful opportunity. And it is an opportunity to love and to show compassion and empathy to our husbands. Wouldn't it have been, imagine if Job had said this instead, "Dost thou still have pain? Let us go to God together and live." Wouldn't we view her completely different than we do? And that's the opportunity that we have. When we're faced with this type of tragedy, unimaginable tragedy that we would never, ever have insight into, if we could turn to God just like that, "Dost thou still have pain? Let us go to God together and live." She could have washed his sores. She could have cleaned the ash from his head and dressed him with tender, loving hands. Because that's what a helpmeet does, right? Well, what is the Christian wife's response to marital struggles? You know, the fairy tale wedding that we often dream of and have, you know, as little girls, and we think about all of the beautiful things that we're going to have at our wedding and our wedding gown and all that. Well, that comes crashing to an end when the first bills arrive, right? My husband went to college on scholarships. I went to college on student loans. So 6 months after we got married, suddenly all those bills from Fried Hardeman came due. I mean, did they not know we had just gotten married and we're making $260 a week living in that single wide trailer? But suddenly we had all of these bills due, and many marriages do begin with crushing student debt, right? Conflict with the in-laws, life-altering decisions concerning career choices. Combine these issues with two inexperienced adults learning how to live together, and often terrible decisions are made business-wise. My husband and I laugh a lot about, I don't know what time it is. Y'all have to tell me if I need to quit. We laugh often about those first 6 months of our marriage because we made some of the worst decisions. See, he thought I was paying the bills. I thought he was paying the bills. He thought I was keeping the checkbook. I thought he was keeping the checkbook. Because in his home, his mom did it all. In my home, my dad did it all. So suddenly, we started getting past due bills and insufficient funds from the bank. It's like, what is going on? And we're looking at each other like, what have you done? So one of the deacons, bless his heart, was the banker at the church. And he came over to our house and he said, well, get your check register out. And I looked at him blankly. I said, what is that? He said, you know, when you write your checks down on the book that came with your checkbook, And I said, oh, no, I don't keep that. He said, okay, how do you know how much money you have in the bank? And I said, and I looked at BJ, and he's looking at me. We're both like deer in the headlights, you know. This man was the picture of stoicism, you know. And I said, well, I have the receipts. He goes, okay, get those. I'm pulling receipts from my purse. I'm pulling receipts from the drawer in the kitchen. BJ's pulling them out of his pocket. We have this little pile of receipts on the table. He builds a checkbook for us, a register for us, and figures out, he looks at me and he goes, okay, first of all, you need to get a job. And I have a job for you. You're going to go Monday morning to Edward D. Jones and Company because he's looking for a branch office administrator and he knows me really well and I'm going to tell him to hire you. So, long story short, that's what happened. And my husband keeps the checkbook. He calls himself the banker, so he knows what's going on. We didn't go through all these years of premarital counseling or anything like that, but I will tell you, when those insufficient funds started coming through and past due bills and we didn't have any money in the bank account, it was like, what are we, I mean, you're like, what are you going to do? And the strain and the emotional feeling and the nervousness, and he as the husband, a deacon, is coming over to fix this. It was very devastating. Okay. You don't really go through too much premarital counseling about finances, young ladies. So talk it out before you get married. Sit down. Your parents are the best ones to help you because I guarantee you they went through some problems themselves figuring it out. Okay. Now let's fast track back to Job. He was a man of great financial success. And yet he still had a day when all of this happened in Job 1:9 and Job 1:6, 13, 2:1. And for most couples, there will be a day when, and we will face financial tragedy of some kind. Whether it's the loss of a job, some kind of a physical, like a surgery or cancer or something, we're going to face financial struggle. So when that happens, how should a Christian wife respond? How do we handle it? When the events are dissected, many couples in the Bible went through the same kind of difficult things. Let's talk about Sarai and Abram. They were in the land of Ur in Genesis 12. And her husband was told to leave, to go. Well, they left. If you look at the archaeological land of Ur, Ur was not a primitive city. It was a very wealthy city. Probably many two-story homes. They had indoor plumbing. So she left a land of wealth to be a nomad and travel in tents. And what do we know about Sarai? Did she complain about that? She didn't complain about that in any way. She left a beautiful home to dwell in a tent. Houses are temporary, ladies. Don't put your stock in your home. My mother was a real estate agent in Atlanta, and she called it the Golden Ghetto. Everybody bought the huge, expensive mansions in Atlanta, but they couldn't afford to put the furniture in them, okay? So does my spouse understand that I will stand by his side even in financial ruin? That I'll shop at Goodwill if I need to? Does he understand that? She traveled in tents with dirt and dust and through lands of the strangers. She knew the song, "This World Is Not My Home." Materialism is the root of many financial woes, and we need to get that out of us. Well, what about Noah's wife? Noah was called to build the ark in a wicked and perverse generation, right? She could have been a Jezebel and influenced her husband to sin. Yet think about her. Many of us are preachers' wives in here. She stood by her husband decade after decade after decade while he built a monstrous-sized vessel that had never been seen before, while he preached to the masses and was constantly ridiculed. Do you think he came home with discouragement? Do you think day in and day out, she probably had to encourage him to continue on? She stood by him, even in the face of ridicule. She didn't let the friends in the town that she had sway her. The fact that he was building this monstrous ship. No, she stood by him. She walked a godly walk as a wife. What about Priscilla and Aquila? Priscilla and Aquila, she left Rome. They traveled to Corinth. She stood by her husband. They were tent makers. They took in this Apostle Paul who had been beaten and shipwrecked, and many Christians were scared of him and all that he had been through. They took him in and they stood side by side with him. She worked with her husband, even though the work was tedious and backbreaking. And that's not all she did, though. She walked the Christian walk with him, and we can read about them in Acts 18, and we know they didn't live in peaceful times. They lived in an era of possible martyrdom, beatings, and imprisonment as Christians. She did more than just declare that she was a Christian and help her husband as a tent maker. She walked the path with him. She was forefront in the battle for the Lord and stood by her husband's side. Don't you think that Aquila would have been someone that maybe tended to Paul's wounds if he had been beaten when she was around? And that's the kind of wife that we need to have. Life was fragile, and she stood up to it, didn't she? It was a turbulent and violent time, and the Christians were treated in torturous ways, and she did not tell her husband to curse God and die. I want to leave you with a Christian's wife's response very quickly in the preacher's home. And I want you to think about Proverbs 31 that says, the heart of her husband doth safely trust in her. Did the heart of Job trust in his husband? No. You know what I'm saying. I'm seeing like 2 minutes back there. I want you to remind your husband when he gets discouraged of all of these things, that there is a fire in his bones, like Jeremiah 20, 8 through 9, that he's needed to preach the word, 2 Timothy 4, 2. 1 Corinthians 15, 58, the first sermon my husband ever preached was called Abounding in the Lord, and that he can abound again in God. Remind him of that. Remind him that his message is not in vain, Isaiah 55, 10 through 11. Remind him that the harvest is coming. Even if we only see, like Noah's family, the harvest of a few, the harvest is coming. That his hope is in the Lord, Isaiah 40, 31, and that God has not forgotten him, Philippians 4, 19. Because your preacher husbands can get discouraged. I will never forget my husband coming to me about 20 years ago and telling me he was going to quit preaching. Ladies, that's the last thing he needed to do. You need to remind him. Remind him how vital he is in the Lord's work and that you will stand by him. Two are better than one because they have a good reward for their labor. For if they fall, the one will lift up his fellow. Ecclesiastes 4, 9, and 10. And just like that word together that we found from the very beginning in Genesis, if Job's wife had walked with him together through all of that, we might have more of her recorded in the book of Job. Who knows? We can learn to walk together with our husband through whatever we face. Thank you.